Okay. Welcome back to your regularly scheduled programming. We all took the exam, so that happened. I have graded homeworks on the exams yet. I just got back, so that will happen. I hope it went okay. I'll let you know if there were any issues. Bill seemed to think it was okay, so, at least functionally. And yes, Professor Mielis and I always coordinated on our teacher choice. So let's pick up where we had left off. We were talking about these observational tests. We had talked a lot about the standard candle and standard rod. And now I want to talk about number counts, both as a function of apparent magnitude and redshift. And so the idea is to test the volume of the metric. Where these two are basically you're looking for some standard rod or candle, so you can measure either the luminosity distance or the angular size distance. At redshift, so you get pairs of measurements of those, and it picks out a particular model from the set of possibilities of the FLRW cosmology. So that's one way of testing it. The other is number counts, and these are useful when you don't have a standard candle, but you do have some idea what the distribution of luminosities is, like the luminosity function that tells you how many objects there are of a given magnitude. And so you can integrate over that distribution to basically have an effective standard rod, but you have to look at a big volume to do that. So these things depend on the volume of the metric, which is, of course, just the 3D version of the distance. So I put these up here so they're in your notes. I don't expect anyone to grasp them or even get to use them this semester, but there's a lot of this work has gone on off and on in spurts when it becomes possible, and JWST has opened up a new bin for that. So this is going on a lot right now. Same thing happened with the Hubble Deep Fields, and before that with large ground-based telescopes in the 90s making very deep number counts of galaxies. So this is the sort of thing you have to do in order to interpret one of these deep field images in terms of cosmology. And so there are sort of two basic flavors of this. The more precise one is the number and division of redshift. So again, you get counts. Don't have a standard candle now. You don't know what the luminosity is. But you have some idea of what the luminosity function of those sources is. So that phi of L in there, that is the number of galaxies at a given luminosity per cubic megaparsec. Right, so not just pretending that all galaxies are the same luminosity, but measuring what the luminosity distribution is. And then integrating over that. And you'll recognize in this initially ugly looking term, the leading terms of the Taylor expansion of the distances. Right, so there's the main volume, that's just a sphere in terms of redshift. And so that's the leading term, and then you get another term depending on what the deceleration parameter is. And so the volume will be bigger or smaller depending on whether Q is smaller or bigger. And so this looks awkward, but it's not quite as terrible as it looks written down. On the other hand, it's even worse, because in practice you have to do this numerically and worry about selection effects and all sorts of fun things like that. To apply this test, you not only have to count the number of things that you see, but you also have to measure each of their redshifts. That's a lot of work, so we don't always have that information. So you can integrate that out and have the number magnitude relation. So here I've done it in terms of the flux, the way we talked about on the first homework for the Euclidean case. Now the geometry is not Euclidean, but Robertson-Walker. So you get these extra terms, but you still recognize there's the flux, the -3/2. There's the distance in terms of luminosity and flux, and the cosmological units there. And that dependence to the 3/2 on the luminosity, because brighter things are easier to see. So you can integrate over to luminosity now, just to find out how many objects there are at a given flux in this image. So the nearby ones are bright, easy to see, but the farther away ones are faint and there are a lot more of them. So you're literally just counting galaxies here, the same exercise the Herschels did for stars to start to work out the structure of the Milky Way. Take a slice of the sky, a known area, count, okay, there are 6 galaxies in the brightest magnitude bin. If you were Hipparchus, you'd say those are galaxies of the first magnitude. And then you look for the next level and the next level and count them up, and you get some number as a function of apparent magnitude. And so we had stopped last time with this plot from an old review of Sandage's, which showed how the volume element differs as a function of redshift. So down in this low redshift limit, it's Euclidean, volume increases as a cube of redshift. But as you get to high redshift, you start to split out. And so by redshift of 1, you can start to distinguish between a decelerating universe, something that's at the critical value, like a Rankine matter equals 1, is Q0.5, and something that's very close to the coasting limit, and that Q0.03 is not a perverse choice. That is basically a good guess for what the density of just baryons is. It's an obvious limit to consider, and that was known at the time. We already knew about Big Bang nucleosynthesis way back when. So by counting up the numbers here, we can hope to distinguish each of these curves, and it's pretty sensitive because you're not just depending on the redshift, but the cube of the redshift, and so you start to see things differently. It goes in the same sense that we talked about, of course, that for a decelerating universe, it has not expanded as much as an universe that's coasting or being accelerated. So you expect fewer counts. Just the volume is smaller in a universe that has been decelerating. And counterwise, one that's almost coasting is not a much bigger volume. Even in that limit, you do not remain at z cubed because the geometry is not Euclidean. So that's just something that's fundamentally different here. But you can hope to tell the difference between these things just by counting galaxies on the sky. Of course, a lot can go wrong. So this, we went through a period in the 90s where we were obsessed with the faint blue galaxy problem. But this is a worked example of what we're talking about, so let me step you through it. So what we're looking at here is galaxy counts, the number of galaxies per square degree, right? So you have some area on the sky, per magnitude bin, or in this case they divided up into half magnitude bins, but basically, so you say everything between 23 and a 23.5, and then you count how many galaxies are in that magnitude bin here. So basically measure the magnitudes of all the galaxies in this slice and then plot up the numbers. Of course, the more area you survey and the deeper you look, the fainter you can see, so the better you do. And so certainly by the early 90s, we had recognized that there were too many galaxies of faint magnitudes. It's this excess. Here are the counts in different pass bands. It's the blue band, the I band, the K band. The excess was worse in the blue than in the K, so it's the faint blue galaxy problem. People really were bent out of shape about this. And so why is that? Okay, so here are the counts. The data points are just that. You go out and do the exercise I described of just counting galaxies and plotting up how many there are in each of these magnitude bands. Now the trick is building these lines. What should we expect? Right? Observationally, it's straightforward to count things, but okay, how do we do the test? So you have to know what that luminosity function is and integrate it over it. And the first time people did this, they just said, okay, we've measured the luminosity function locally, which itself is non-trivial, and extrapolate that to high redshift as if it's not evolving. And that fails badly, because galaxies evolve. We know that's not true. The stars in galaxies evolve. And even if you have a simple case like a globular cluster that makes all its stars at a fixed early time and just evolves from there, you have to account for that luminosity evolution. And galaxies are more complicated than globular clusters. They have multiple periods of star formation. Okay, so that's what these different lines are. So let's start with the solid and long dashed lines. That's a no evolution model. So that's just taking the local galaxy population and asking what would we see if that were unchanging in time. What would we see to high redshift in these two models? And again, these are reasonable limits. This is something close to the baryon density as we know it today, close to the coasting limit. And here is the critical density model, which at the time was known as standard CDM. That was what people believed should be the right answer. And so that dashed line here is way off the data. The solid line is also way off the data, though not by as much. And you can see the difference between those lines is what I described, the difference in the volume element between a universe that's decelerating somewhat rapidly and one that's just almost coasting. All right, so you get more volume in that universe that's near the coasting limit because the expansion has not been retarded by gravity. But you're still way off, and that's true in each of these bands. It's okay down here, good, right? Euclid works. If you look closely, it's not great down here, and so people talked about whether or not we lived in a local hole. It had to be a pretty darn big underdensity that we happen to live in, and that argument gets re-sparked off and on and never seems to work out, but anyway. The real issue is where you start to diverge here, and that divergence is more clear in the blue band than in the K band, which is suggestive of an evolutionary effect. Right? You make a bunch of stars. The bright stars are all hot blue stars, and they evolve away quickly, so you can imagine that changing. So we have to account for the evolution. And so you can make reasonable models for the evolution of the galaxies that we have, and I'll talk about that more. But so that's what these two lines are. These are sort of a first guess at what a reasonable evolutionary track would be. So short dashed and dotted lines. And the short dash comes a lot closer, the dotted line does not. So again, the standard model, that is what we thought at the time was standard, omega matter equals one, really falls down badly here, and simply accounting for the evolution that we expect doesn't cut it. The coasting case comes a lot closer to the data, so one might infer from that, okay, well, we don't live in this sort of theoretical standard model, we live something closer to the coasting limit. But that still has a deficit here, the faintest magnitudes, so there's a big deficit if we want to believe in that model, which a lot of us did want to believe at the time. There's still a deficit here, but it's not so terrible. In either case, the first thing to do is invoke some extra evolutionary term. Maybe we didn't get this quite right. And of course, we never get it quite right. It's very complicated. So you didn't have to do a lot for the coasting limit. for the, to recover the standard CDM limit, you did have to do a lot, so that's what this dash dot line is, and it does fit the data pretty well. Of course, that's what it was invoked to do. So the quote at the time was that that standard model fit is improved when an extra high redshift galaxy population with constant star formation rate at z greater than 1 and then fading rapidly at z less than 1 is invoked. You're just making up an extra population here that was going on gangbusters, forming stars up until redshift 1 and then just stops. Okay, that fits the data, so then that motivates a search for those populations at that high redshift. But it's also a big fudge, right? You're just making up some galaxies. And those should have some kind of low redshift counterpart that we should go out and find. And if they fade fast, then they're hard to see, but they're not invisible. One ought to be able to see their remnants. And so that's where I came into this, actually. I was looking for those very low surface brightness things. And even at the time, that didn't really jive well with what we were seeing, because most of the low surface brightness galaxies that we could find were still actively star forming and not fading away. Nowadays, there's yet an additional population that does match that, called the ultra diffuse galaxies. Whether we can go back and retroactively fix that, I don't know, because that ship has sailed. But anyway, that's the game, right? And so, in principle, this is a really sensitive test. In practice, you have to understand galaxies really well. So what are we doing here? We have this thing, and as a mathematical exercise, we need to get to the number density. We have to get this notional quantity that integrates over all these things. I've emphasized integrating over the luminosity function. In principle, that luminosity function can be a function of morphological type. I'll talk a little more about that in a moment. But basically, you need to know what the distribution of luminosities is. You also need to know what the space distribution is. So we usually assume that's uniform, cosmological principle, right? But in detail, that may not be good enough. So to do this right, you need to know what the density distribution of things is. That makes it hard, because then you actually have to go out and measure it. So we persist in assuming it's uniform, which, if you get far enough out, is hopefully true. And then, of course, you have to integrate over the volume element. So this first step here to get this notional quantity, I've called A, you just integrate over the redshift, and that's just taking out the metric dependence. So that's basically just the first step there. Is it a small universe or a big universe? And people were already arguing as early as the early 90s that, look, there are just too many faint blue galaxies on the sky. The only way we're going to understand that is if we have a much bigger volume element, so Q0 has to be small or even negative. And that was basically an early indication that we need the cosmological constant, which at the time we're like, no, la 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 la, we can do it with evolution. So you do that integral, and you have this quantity then that you can then again integrate over type and magnitude to get the actual number density of galaxies as a function of each on the sky. So there's a lot of math involved to do this right, and in practice we have to do it numerically, because none of these quantities have a nice analytic expression, except for this one in special limits, like when Q0 is 0 or a half. Okay, so that's what's being done in order to take data like this and compare it to models like that. Now, remember morphology. You should all know this from 222, but just as a quick reminder, there are two basic types and details. There are a whole bunch of Hubble types. Not going to sweat that too much, but essentially they're elliptical galaxies and spiral galaxies, or sometimes early and late type galaxies. Those are classic bad astronomy names because different people use them to mean different things, because one could also describe this as an early type spiral as opposed to a late type spiral, like an SCD or something like that. But that's different from an early type galaxy, which is an elliptical. The physical difference between this is a 3D blob of stars, and it'll look more or less the same regardless of which direction you're looking at it from. Now, it's not spherical, it's more like a rugby ball or something, and so it will look more or less elliptical in the sky depending on what your viewing angle is. But it's fundamentally a 3D blob of stars, which can in principle be prolate, oblate, or even triaxial, which is to mean if you measure the principal axes, they can all have different lengths. So there are a bunch of early type galaxies out there, a bunch of spiral galaxies there. Those are all flattened, sometimes modeled as oblate spheroids or simply as squashed cylinders. And so they do look different depending on whether you see them face on or edge on. And if you're in the optical, you have to worry about the extinction for the edge on things, which you can see, and which we can see around Milky Way, would look something like that if seen edge on from outside. And you can do that by looking at the, or can begin to account for that by looking at, for example, colors as a function of inclination, just axis ratios, right? This is face on, so it's about 1:1 axis ratio. Here the axis ratio is very high, 10:1 or something, that's close to edge on. And as you get more edge on, then the dust lane starts to take it out, so that affects the color and the luminosity and things like that. All right, so now what are the luminosity functions of these things? And here I have broken it up by type. That is the T in the integrals I was talking about before. And early type galaxies tend to be big and bright, so the brightest galaxies here, or in this case they've attempted to turn this into a stellar mass, the most massive local galaxies tend to be those elliptical galaxies. Spirals aren't too far behind, and the numbers keep going up to lower luminosity. These are SCD, SD, irregular galaxies as you get to these low stellar masses. Lots of irregular galaxies here, but they all share the property of being flattened cylinders that are rotationally supported, whereas the early types are all big balls of stars with lots of random motion, which is called pressure support. And so then the total galaxy luminosity function is the sum of those things, but the bright end tends, a low redshift tends to be dominated by ellipticals, and the spirals kick in and go up, so that by the time you get to faint things, and not even all that terribly low mass, they're dominated by the late types. A simple formula that is an adequate fit to these things sometimes, but not always, is the Schechter function. So that's an important touchstone to know about. Refer to Schechter functions as a shorthand to describe this distribution. Again, nowadays we don't really need that. We could do everything numerically, just count up how many things are in each bend and do our integrals in the computer. And you'll notice the Schechter function isn't perfect. That's a good Schechter function, that's a good Schechter function. The sum is not. Right? There's this sort of inflection there, and that is a fairly common feature, at least in galaxy clusters. Sometimes you even see a little notch there, so the transition from one to the other. But anyway, this is a simple analytic formula. Simple, perhaps it's too generous. It is an analytic formula that we can use to describe the shape of this. And it has three parameters: the characteristic luminosity, that's the knee where you get the bend, the change in slope. The characteristic number density, which is how many of these typical things are they. Now when you do this, so we'll put L star, it's right, E. If you put L star in here, this is one, but this is not. So V-Star is not the density of L-star galaxies, but it's close. So there's a characteristic luminosity, there's a characteristic number density, and then there's some parameter for the faint-end slope, which in this case is steep, in this case is actually declining, so there are fewer of these things in this analysis. And so these numbers are really hard to come by. The same group has updated this recently and increased the stellar mass by 0.2 dex, and I hear they're going to move it back down again. So that's the sort of issue you get when you turn your luminosity that you measure, which you can do, into a stellar mass, which depends on your stellar population model. So a lot of that motion is in the translation of luminosity to stellar mass rather than in the actual data. Okay, so how do we do this? This is important to understand. Here is the idealized selection function for galaxies as a function of their luminosity and their surface brightness. And this is specific to late-type galaxies that have exponential distributions. You get a somewhat different function for early-type galaxies because their light profiles are different. And that matters. Basically, galaxies are not point sources. So you can imagine going out and doing a survey. And saying, OK, I'm going to find all galaxies above some magnitude limit. But that's not really true, because the surface brightness profiles of angular size here have some functional form. And in practice, you can only see down to some isophoto limit. Now, this is the surface brightness, right? That's the amount of light per unit area. So you can imagine some nice bright galaxy like this, where the central surface brightness is way up above that limit. And you can measure an isophotal radius and add up the light inside of that, and that's all fine. But the point of drawing this is that there's always an effective isophoto limit in addition to your magnitude limit. So you can imagine letting this thing become lower surface brightness, and now less of it sticks up above your isophoto limit. You get, when you integrate that up, you get a little less, smaller fraction of the total light, and at some point, this thing just becomes unnoticeable. That is to say, there is some background haze on the sky that is irreducible. If you're doing these surveys from the surface of the Earth, which you almost inevitably are, then that limit is due to sky glow of various kinds. You can't do it during the day because the sun lights up the atmosphere. You can't do it during full moon because the moon lights up the atmosphere, so you have to do it in the dark of the moon. And you're still, there are things that happen in the atmosphere that make it glow at several levels, so you just can't see these things very well. So there's always an effective limit. Now we're finally to the point of launching spacecraft like Euclid, which will have a big field of view, and you can actually survey a lot of the sky, both at HSD resolution and where it's really dark. And so we'll be able to push this down and see things really well. But we're not quite there yet. And even then, there is some cosmic background light from basically all the galaxies that you don't resolve far, far away. So there's always an implicit surface brightness limit as well as a magnitude limit. And that's true for any extended object, anything that's not a point source. You have to worry about both of those things. And so what's plotted here is the volume that over which you can see an object as a function of both its absolute magnitude and some measure of its surface brightness. And I used the central surface brightness for an exponential disk to make this plot, so it's the intercept of that. You can use the effective surface brightness or some other measure. And you can see what you know intuitively, that something that's bright and high surface brightness is really easy to see. But as the luminosity goes down, this falls off. Oops, that way is the luminosity fall off. Same thing for the surface brightness. Not too much for the higher surface brightness things at first, but then it goes completely away for the really low surface brightness things. So you get that kind of curve coming along there. And this is what surface you have to be able to figure out applies for your survey in order to correct to the right numbers. So this is not the numbers you see, this is the numbers corrected for this volume selection function. And like I say, this depends on the surface brightness profile, so I've drawn exponential profiles there for late-type galaxies. Here are examples of the surface brightness profile for early-type galaxies, the J and the B for the same galaxy. And again, you can see there's some point where you just don't see the galaxy anymore, right? It's really obvious there, but as you get further out, where does that light end? Well, it doesn't have a hard edge, it just sort of tapers off, and so how much light you think's there depends on how much of that you detect. It is falling off rapidly, so at some point you do basically get it all, but you have to be aware of where that limit is. Now going back to exponential late-type galaxies, just to give you a visual feel for how big an effect this is, here is a high surface brightness spiral on a survey plate. This is from the HAAS 2 survey plate. It used to be that if you wanted to survey a large area of sky, the only way to do it was to use a photographic plate, which is much larger than CCDs. It's only recently that that ceased to be true. You look at it and they're, okay, there are a bunch of stars. Aha, a galaxy, right? Easy to see that one. Here's something else you go through. Oh, yeah, there's something there. Should I count that or not? And the only difference, I've picked these two examples because the only difference between these things is the central surface brightness. They have about the same scale length on the sky, and in fact, I picked them to be at about the same distance as well. So the basically, they're twin galaxies, except for that central intercept being much lower for that, and that's the actual data for that galaxy. So look harder and crank up the contrast. You see this thing has spiral structure, and it extends over a similar size as that thing. So that really is the difference. It's just that the low surface brightness is so low that it fades into the background of the haze back here, and that's what I'm talking about with the selection limit. You would not just on the raw images recognize that this thing is as big as that thing. And so that makes a difference to this selection function. Whoop, where you live in there. One of them's up here, the other's down here, and so for every one of these things that you see, there's several of those things, just because you can see these things much more easily. So that's what you're trying to account for in that volume selection function, which is tricky to compute. But that limit, the isophoto limit, is a real one. So this is a review I did a long time ago now, but basically this is surface brightness and scale length, so the distribution of galaxies in that exponential disk plane. There are things that are high surface brightness, there are things that are large, there are things that are small, and you can just calculate what the limit from your survey is going to be, and there is a limit. At the time I did it, the best surveys could reach limits of about 26 magnitudes per square arc second in the B band. And you don't see any galaxies below that. Basically everything was up there. So there was no reason to think there weren't galaxies down there. We just weren't seeing them given the survey types. And there were some anecdotal cases known that were found as one-offs, not in some systematic survey that had a well-defined surface brightness limit. And that's now, basically, that was the line demarcating what we could do then from what we could do now, and so all these ultra-diffuse galaxies live down here. So it's just what we expected. There's nothing special about this limit. That's just how faint we could see. And when we were able to look fainter, we see more things. Couple of things that are limits here, physical limits. So that's just an observational selection limit. Up here, there is a high surface brightness limit. That's basically what used to be known as the Freeman law. But there are no super high surface brightness disks. They truncate at high surface brightness. And that seems to be a stability limit. The disks, if you make them too compact, become gravitationally unstable, make a bar, and tear themselves apart. So there is some limit on how high surface brightness you can make the disk. And there's also an upper limit on the total luminosity. There's a cutoff, that Schechter value of L star, where galaxies become exponentially rare, much above that. So you can see both of those. Those are physical limits. This is not. That's just an observational limit. And so to actually get a proper accounting of the number of galaxies in some unit of volume of space out there, you need to count up the ones you can see and correct for the ones that you can't see that often. And it's really tricky to do that calculation right. But that's what you want to do if you want to turn this, the raw observations, into a luminosity. So this is the number of galaxies, just raw, no corrections, seen in whatever edition of the Sloan survey it was when I made this plot. And you can see two competing effects here. One is that bright cutoff. That's because there really are no super bright galaxies. Right? If those existed, we could see them easily. Right? They're bright. So there is a real physical cutoff there. Galaxies don't get much bigger than this. The other side, though, the number declining there is just entirely due to this volume selection. These faint galaxies are a lot harder to see than these intermediate galaxies are harder to see than the bright galaxies. So this side is the decline in numbers that you're trying to correct for by calculating that volume luminosity function. And I'm emphasizing that this is a two-parameter exercise, at least. You can also make it a function of type, et cetera, color, whatever. But it's much easier to do this if they're point sources, and all you have to worry about is the absolute magnitude. Galaxies are not point sources. You can't get away with that. But so now, to come back to the luminosity function, this has been done. So this is the luminosity function measured by the gamma survey, starting from a distribution that looks like this. Right. So this is the numbers that you get. This is the number densities that you insert, the intrinsic volume. And there's a huge volume correction for the faint things. Right. And that's because this, you can see very few of these compared to those. That volume function is what maps the parent numbers to the intrinsic numbers. So there are very few of these things in catalogs, but they represent a big chunk of the total galaxy population because you only see them nearby. Another assumption we're implicitly making here to make that volume correction is the cosmological principle. The universe is homogeneous, so that we are sampling a fair volume here and can just extrapolate that. But there's some point where that's not going to be true, where these numbers are so small that maybe we got lucky and hit a dense pocket, or maybe unlucky, and that should also affect the numbers. So it's a tricky business to get that right. And I think these people have done a really good job, which is why I show that particular luminosity function. And for a long time, this was hard to do, and people disagreed. And I think we've finally converged to more or less the same answer.